Welcome to this episode of the Level Design Podcast. In this episode, we wander through some virtual cities, admiring the view with the wonderful game urbanist Konstantinos Dimopoulos. Let's get on with the show. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to this new episode of the Level Design Podcast. I am joined with my wonderful co-host, Jonathan Wilson, a level designer for Hangar 13.
Hey.
And Valentina Chrysostomou, a mission designer, technical game designer, and a level designer, all-round awesome person. And last but not least, very special guest, Konstantinos Dimopoulos, who's a game urbanist. We had to have you on the show if you're a game urbanist. Come on, that's a one-off title.
Yes, indeed. And hello, everyone.
Hello.
So it's been an interesting time to record these podcasts, and we have to face it head on. We have access to the world's geniuses because I know exactly where they are. They can't say that they're out of their house, having a life. So we've been lucky enough to get Konstantinos on the show.
You're far too kind. I always wanted, I actually thought about coming to the show ever since I first heard it, and I started scheming and plotting to get my decent microphone.
You sent me a tweet with like a picture of your microphone going like, I have a microphone now.
Indeed I did. It was an exciting
like,
day.
And like, right, let's book him. Now he can actually talk. Because otherwise it'd be like...
Yes, this is how I usually sound.
So, I mean, you studied urban studies. You've got a PhD in urban studies. And so this is like a proper profession.
Yeah, it is, it is.
No, if you've got a PhD in it, you must be well smart.
Genial, I would say.
Smarter than us, for sure.
You are an actual urban planner, right?
Yes, so, yes, like, that is true.
What I find really incredible is that you studied all of this, but at the same time, you were like an editor for a magazine called Button Smasher, right?
Oh yes, this was ancient times. Yeah, at some point I sort of did that. It was like, you know, this hobby that started going places like very slowly, but not in a convincing way.
Mm-hmm. You know, well, the game stuff, like working with games or the urban planning stuff.
Exactly.
Because urban planning, if you call that a hobby and you have a PhD in it, that's like a hell of a hobby.
That's a great hobby.
You've been doing two things. You've been doing like urban planning, but also doing like writing and editing for like Rock Paper Shotgun.
Yes, at some point too.
At some point back in the teens?
I think yes, at some point there. And maybe before that, we had also started, we formed a small indie studio with a few friends, and we released a couple iOS games. You know, at some point, it simply became unsustainable to try and do science in Greece. It was actually impossible. Mm-hmm. And since it became impossible, I mean, there was no essential risk in trying something, you know, more fun out. You know, like working with games that never sounded like a real job.
Right.
It isn't a job. It's always entertaining, even if it's exhausting. It's fun. It's interesting.
You've been doing all this stuff, but then it became like just full disclosure. You and I have talked before.
True.
About some games, about, you know, in a proper professional setting environment, consulting on a game that I was developing, and we were talking about. And this is why I wanted to have you on the show, because you go beyond anything that we could call level design, because it's urban design. It's like level design on the biggest realist scale that you can talk about, right?
Yes, but it's also level design, and in some instances it's not level design at all. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's just with the fact that cities themselves are so multifaceted and can be attacked from all those angles and, you know, played with in all those ways. Sometimes it's about level design. Like, for example, when you discuss, you know, how an open world, an urban open world setting would have to be organized, this will have to be level design. But when you want to come up with concepts for, you know, cities for, I don't know, an adventure game or rules for a strategy game, then it wears off and it gets like more generalized, weirder, like breaks the bounds of level design. It's difficult to define, and you know, every sort of thing I've done so far is always different to the previous one. So it's sometimes it's level design, sometimes it's not.
One of the games that I have played that I know that you've worked on is The Sinking Cities by Frogwares.
Yes, mm-hmm.
Which is the awesome Lovecraftian detective. Because it's very Lovecraftian, it horror is. Thing, right? With it fish is, people wandering around. But from a city perspective, just the parts that I played were like very much, you know, here's the docks and this is the things that you'd have here. And here's the mansion and here's the different areas. And each area is kind of very distinct and grown into its pattern.
True. And
if that makes sense.
The truth be said, I mean, what I mainly did in... And the Sinking City was like consult during the pre-production period for a few months.
Mm-hmm.
What does that look like? We're consulting on game cities.
Oh, it's once again, it's, you know, it really depends on the case. But this particular one, it was like more like, you know, coming up with a document of what we would probably need to showcase if we are to create, you know, a convincing yet also unsettling place, and lots of Skype chatting and. You know, trying to think of solutions that would essentially cut costs. Because, I mean, this was not a AAA studio. I mean, it was a big, impressive, in many respects, studio. But Frogwares is not like you don't have access to 500 people.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's way more subtle than that. So it's interesting. It involves a lot of talking and a lot of back and forth and a lot of sketches and, you know, the occasional Excel shit. Because everything involves some spreadsheet of sorts.
I've noticed this is the one of the horrible things that the big secrets of game design. It's mainly spreadsheets.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not mainly spreadsheets, but a lot of it then boils down to spreadsheets. I was working on some dialogue stuff recently, and I went, well, this is going to go in a spreadsheet, isn't
this?
It? Because
yep.
We all use spreadsheets eventually. You can't avoid them.
True.
As we mentioned earlier, you've both worked on games, but you're also trying to showcase a lot of cities and games with a book that you're writing that we were talking about earlier.
Virtual cities.
Yes.
It's Virtual Cities, right?
Yes.
That's the name. I should be
this,
a bit more
this
prepared,
is the exact name. Yes, this is, you're very right about the name. It's called Virtual Cities. And I've actually finished writing it since over a year ago.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yes.
Can I not buy it yet?
Because I've also finished the edit. I'm very fast at doing stuff, so I've also finished the edits and everything, and we're apparently going through, you know, proofs and making small changes, and there's the publisher's schedule and everything. Now we have you know, a publication date for September, but it's I don't know what's going to happen with the, you know, whole coronavirus thing and how it affects shipping and publishing and printing in China and everything. So this will have to be settled. But I mean, my job on the thing has finished, and I'm just, you know, helping improve little things here and there.
It's making these real things that really takes some time, right? Because you can make games, but once you have to print that onto a DVD, is onto a Blu-ray disc, and actually get that physical disc. Some packaging and actually getting that thing. I mean, for books, it's the same thing. It's actually getting some trees, making them into pulp and putting words on it and getting that across the world.
It's the physicality of things that both makes, you know, the logistics more complicated.
Yeah.
But also, you know, it's physicality itself is a beautiful thing, occasionally.
My friend, I wrote a book. This is nothing related as well. I have the book here. Ooh. It has my name on it. It's like it's the most amazing thing. But I don't think I signed it. But you know, like I'm showing everyone a book.
Excellent.
I'm sure I'm going to put a link in the show notes.
Yes,
for you,
please
so
do.
I can make
and for us
make
to.
Another 3 cents on it. It's a technical book. You don't want to read it. But
I'm really interested about the book about Virtual Cities. How do you begin writing a book about cities in video games? What was the process about that?
The process, I mean, it all started as a, you know, a very, very relaxed discussion with a friend. And she's the friend who actually did the illustrations for the book. As, you know, another thing that we should at some point try doing together, and what could we do together? And, you know, she sort of likes games. Well, she's played a few, but she's more interested in the visual aspect of games. And so we started talking with Maria, and we came up with this idea that it could be interesting to have an atlas. And I have this weird, you know, obsession with old typographies and old publishing approaches, and I wanted to, you know, go for the old feeling of the atlas, like you read about places you are never going to probably visit, and it will help you conjure images into your mind, and I don't want them to be too detailed, and I don't want, you know, to have like screenshots or something, you know, just like intrigue people the way an old atlas would intrigue them. And we started taking it from there, and then, you know, narrowing down the cities, deciding on style and how they will have to be described, whether the description will be like in world, and how to, you know, also provide tips and ideas and suggestions for the people who design the mini games, like what are the crucial things to take note of in every particular case. Do a map that would be like diegetically correct and sensible and hopefully visually interesting. And it's something that took quite some time, and it must have taken at least, if we counted it in 40-hour weeks, it would have been like, I don't know, 3 or 3.5 years.
Wow.
In 100-hour weeks, it's a bit less. So this is the route I went for, because it's... Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It wasn't wise.
I mean, I have to say, I have my pre-order, so I'm waiting for it.
Yes, yes, I know. Thank you. No, I think it ended out really good, decent. I mean, I like it. I don't hate it, which is good.
That's always a good sign when you can say that about your own work, because usually it's like, yes, once you're done, no, never want to see it again. Throw it away. But
yes, exactly. So this is it. I mean, I'm still fond of it. I look at it and it's yeah, good. It's decent. It's yeah, nice.
You can even relate that to level design, though, right? You build a level, you work on it for so long, you get to the point, never want to see this again. So, but it's not so much that the level's bad. It's just you've worked on it for so long, you just don't want to look at it anymore.
Yeah.
Like I have a tally for some things in my missions that I've done before, and it's just for one character I've had the script every time he doesn't do what I want, I'll shoot him, and I just have a tally going up every time. But the one time he doesn't do what he needs to, that's it. You've got to keep yourself in the team.
Well,
I am always astounded by the amount of output that you're doing. You do such great work both in the virtual cities, which I guess now I've realized you've got a bit more time, but you're sort of like, I don't know what the proper word is, you write a column for Wireframe.
Yes.
Every Fortnite?
Yes, every
is
Fortnite.
It is. Yeah.
It's for every Fortnite. It's... no, this is...
And they're good columns, by the way. This is not like here's a throwaway thing. Yeah.
No, they take time. They take time. And sometimes, you know, compressing things into 1,000 words or trying to avoid getting too technical is sometimes more time-consuming and more demanding than expected, but it's a good exercise. It keeps you, you know, it keeps you thinking and writing about those things in a more structured way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's feedback, which is good. You know, I think that someday those articles will form the basis for another book at some point.
I think they're worth it. I mean, not that I'm just a major fan of both Wireframe magazine and your articles in it. I think they're very detailed. If someone was starting out in trying to create a believable city, or what tips would you say, or maybe what tips would you not do, or things to avoid or things to do? I mean, you've been writing articles for weeks. You can surely condense this in 50 words.
Yeah, probably. No, truth be said, is that the major thing, the two major things, is that first of all, you have to keep in mind that things should make sense. And I do not mean that in the sense of things will have to be realistic, as in, you know, everyday life cities. What they have to do is be like cohesive and believable and internally coherent, even in the most exotic ways possible. You have to keep in mind that this is an illusion that you will have to sustain in every chance you get. So things must be like, feel as part of the same world. This is probably the way to put it. And that's the one thing. And the second thing is that when you start actually designing a city, try to approach it as a city. Do not try to approach it as, you know, a section, a district, a house, something. Think of it as a city. Have a very draft sketch. You know, note down a few districts. Try and imagine what it does. How does it work? And why do people live there? Those sort of very, very basic things that people do occasionally tend to skip over.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do those fundamentals, it will be easier for you to move on and move on to the details and decide how the roads will look like and how people will dress. And this is the third thing, because there are like probably way too many things to note, but keeping in mind that cities are not just, you know, the built environments, not just the walls and the infrastructure and the architecture, but also the people living there, but also, you know, the things happening there, the activity going on, the ideas and the interactions and everything. This will help you, you know, make something that's more interesting. So let's keep it at those three things.
I do find it fascinating when you look at games and they approach like building cities. Obviously, all the studying goes into them, but like when you think of it from a systemic point of view, just like all the systemic systems you put into an open world game is always fascinating, and you always want to do more.
Yes. And my question is, when do we have to stop? I mean, when would it be safe to say that people will not notice the lack of something, or when is it worth putting something in? There has to be an interesting cutoff point at some place.
Yeah, I think it depends on the kind of game you're working on. If you're working on a huge AAA game that is all about the open world, I think you're gonna put a bit more time and money into building that. If the world isn't actually as important and maybe you're focusing on the story, it's a bit more linear, I guess the environments might not get as much love. It depends on the studio too, like what they're focusing on. But on something you said before that got me thinking, you said cities are all about the people who live there and what they do, their culture, etc. So one thing we're actually missing, I think, in games is cities and towns and everything just changing over time in the game. Yeah. For example, if like a gang and they start shooting, why aren't the things getting destroyed in the part of the you know, where the shooting happened, and why don't we see, I don't know, more graffiti?
Why don't people
like,
start moving out?
Yeah, why don't we see shops being closed? Mm-hmm. And it's always, the cities never change in games. They're mainly the same, right?
Yes, you're absolutely right. And this is what makes them feel, what often makes them feel as, you know, just scenery.
Yes.
And like, this is a pet peeve of mine. I mean, we've seen like countless cathedrals and countless massive castles, but we've never seen one of them, you know, being constructed. And those things took bloody centuries getting done.
I mean, even now in Barcelona, if you go to the Sagrada Familia, it's still being built, and it's been built since, and by the way, sorry, history buffs, I'm going to get this wrong, but it's like the last 300 years or something?
No, actually, because I was discussing this with a student, actually. And I was telling him
history buff in the flip room.
That Gaudí died, it was around 1915, something like that, like beginning of the 20th century. And it's like, imagine that he died 100 years ago and his modern church is still being built, and it's going to keep on being built for at least another 20 or 30 years, something like that. So it's a process. You don't have just a city and it's done.
Yeah, I think the last game I played that had construction was actually Spider-Man, because it was like all about Fisk's gangs and being in the construction buildings, and that's about it.
A good game. I've seen only fragments of thereof, but it seemed very impressive, and its take on New York was very...
I was just going to say, one of the best parts about that game, I think, is just the city and like the interpretation of New York, just swinging around it. This is not even engaging in content or anything like that, just the purity of walking around the city and seeing it.
True. And this I would argue, is level design. I mean, how they kept the essence of the city and made it fun to play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is definitely something that goes into level design.
I'm not sure, I can't speak for the developers, but when I played it, when you start focusing on the city, though, you see so many things that are just wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Just not sitting properly on things, playing wrong animations, not properly bumping and not following like the exact, I don't know, rules you'd find in an Assassin's Creed game. So I feel like that city is mainly for Spider-Man to swing and fight in. And then when you start actually, when you want to become part of it and become a citizen and just walk around and do like normal things, it starts to fall apart a little bit. So I think in the next game, hopefully we'll make it the next game, they're built on that a bit more.
Yeah, I guess when you look at it like that, this version of Spider-Man was a New York was a playground built for Spider-Man, not Peter Parker.
Yes.
So you weren't the civilian on the ground level. You're meant to be in the rooftops and the back alleys or anything, and you're meant to be super acrobatic and going through the city at a certain pace. But if you try to play as Peter Parker, at least in this version of the game, this is not his playground. So that's why those systems aren't quite, I guess, Assassin's Creed level, like, because you're not in amongst the crowds necessarily.
Yeah, I feel like in those games, like Assassin's Creed, the AI has a routine lives too, and they follow that. So at nighttime, they'll go to sleep, and then they'll go pick up water from the river and that kind of stuff. In Spider-Man, it doesn't feel the same. So it's more like scenery, like you said, Costantino. It's not like, it's not a proper living, breathing world, I'd say.
Yeah, but what I wanted to comment on this, it's what Jonathan said before. It's like that you're probably meant to mainly spectate from afar. So regarding to the first question that I pose is like, when exactly, what is the cutoff point? This could be an answer, like, if we can sort of imagine what the play experience would be for most and what the optimal play experience would be, then this is like the level of fidelity and the things that we focus on. So maybe, I mean, you know, like in a Mirror's Edge, I mean, you don't really care so much about, not even the architecture itself, it doesn't really make much sense.
Yeah, because everything is buildings. And
yeah, it's buildings upon buildings with red pipes, you know, it's like totally weird. But I mean, it sort of works. It just gives you the sense that you want. And it doesn't break your suspension of disbelief. It doesn't make you stop. And if you stop, you'll wonder, but you never stop.
In a game like Mirror's Edge, like, the architecture was interesting, but it was all there just to kind of keep you in the flow, right? Like, this was a game about movement and motion. They didn't really want you to stop, and they were very, like, clear about that. And it has a very open, like, Catalyst was a bit different, but the original Mirror's Edge did have a very bland color palette for a reason. The fact it was, like, mostly white. Yeah. You didn't have a reason to stop. There was nothing to catch your eye other than the thing telling you where to go.
One of the things that we discussed years ago now, I think, is about 2 or 3 years ago when we first talked. A developer, and we were talking about a game called Deeper that was meant to be set deep underground at the time. And one of the questions you asked, which is not a game urbanist question, is like, so what are they doing underground? As in, what are people actually doing? So the population boom is going to explode because they're doing nothing. But if they don't have a job, they're having sex and they're having babies. And if there's food, they just do nothing, right? And I was thinking about this because, well, now everyone's locked in doing
nothing. Yeah, but this things happen for a reason, though. I mean, we're locked in for a reason.
Right.
I think it has to do with 5G no. and something like that. I've confused my conspiracies, but
it has to do something to do with mirrors edges.
I just can't don't look in the mirror.
It's very
in case that's what
exactly
it is.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. That was it.
That's it. That's the one.
Yes. Thank you.
A great. We're now adding to the great
massive misconception.
Bad things. But it's those concepts that. Of like, well, where do people get their food? Where do they poo? Where does that poo go? We had a party the other day on Zoom, and I had to bring a trivia about my city. And I said, like, well, London is actually not London. London City is a tiny square mile surrounded by another city. And the first city's in there is owned by a company, not owned by, well, a corporation, not owned by who you think is owned. And we have two city centres, one's Westminster and the other one's the City of London. And is that thing that you have odd cities all over the place, right? Because cities kind of grow, and you should show those in games because they're actually more interesting.
It's fascinating. I mean, if you look pretty close at reality, you're bound to find amazing examples of weird and interesting things going on. I mean, not just in cities, but also in cities. And if you actually go further in and start, you know, researching history, there are demented places. They're absolutely wonderful and weird, and yet also sensible by definition. I mean, since they existed and since they functioned for maybe hundreds of years, I mean, you can just cherry pick and use wonderful things. People don't do that, though, for some reason. And people do not...
Well, do they come up with a precept and then try to backfill that precept?
I don't know, but I mean, I've run into weird, really weird situations. I mean, in really weird ways of approaching cities, which is... it's not level design either, because I mean, if you think about it, many of the things that would make level design good, like, you know, sensible space, a sense of space, but boundaries that work, and all those things, and they're often missing. And people start talking to you about, you know, this city that just goes on, and it, and then next to the city you have a river, and next to the river you have a castle, and then things are not next to each other. Things are not linear. I mean, things are. I mean, you have to look at them from above. You have to sort of understand the topology. Like, next to something means nothing. It's weird, and definitely people do not tend to ask the question of why are people living here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you have a horror city and you can just go out, I mean, if you could live, I don't know, Yarnath in Bloodborne, why don't you live it? I mean, why are you staying there? You'll die.
Do you have a favorite game that you go to and say, and then you study for its level design or its city design?
No, there are many games I consider, like, very well done. I would say I always mention City 17,
mm-hmm.
which is very clever, and it's very, very economical in its use of assets and everything. There's always Novigrad from Witcher 3, which is very impressive. And there's also always, like, New Bordeaux, which is one of the few cities that, you know, manages to play with nature and the whole natural geography of the city it's based in. And there is I would say Rockville from My Mind Forever Voyaging, which I've grown incredibly fond of lately. And there's New Orleans from you know, Gabriel Knight, and they all do different things, you know, well, but they all feel, you know, great. They don't need something. I mean, always you can definitely go back to anything and add stuff and improve on stuff. But I mean, as an experience and as this sense of civicness, of urbanity, whatever, they got it. You can imagine this place existing, and that's nice. That's
when you get that feeling. I think that's the sign of a complete world, right? And that's when all your systems are working together correctly. Because sometimes you overload a city,
exactly,
and just because you think you need to have all this content, but sometimes, like in that case, less is more, because you can focus and make the things really gel together instead of just, oh, we need this, we need police system, we need fire system, we need waterworks, we need all this. But you could just take the core, and that would work much better.
Absolutely. And you know, sometimes making it legible can work. I mean, I'm thinking, like, you know, very, very obvious districts, or even, you know, even on a macro scale, think of Midgar in Final Fantasy VII. The old one. I don't know how the new one is.
The new one is very good, but we'll go into that on another topic.
It seems impressive, but I haven't found the time to do it. But I mean, the old one, I mean, you instantly realize how it's organized. You have got like two tiers. It's a pizza-like organization. You have a big thing in the center. Simple, legible, sensible.
But I think some of this stuff is making a city understandable for the plot or for the game or game development. One of my favorite cities is actually Mega City 1 from Dread, which I guess is the archaeology, the like the big blocks, the units, you know, the peach trees, for example, was one of them, which is the big living blocks. And you understood that this is poor people living, and they just stay in this building, and this building will get attacked by atomics randomly, so that's why you can close the whole building off. And I was always wondering, like, the people live in these buildings because this must happen from time to time.
Probably.
Because in the beginning, you see, like, a view of the city, and you see these big, they're just called blocks, right? And you're wondering, well, what's happening outside of it? Like, the people that don't live in these blocks, do they just die off every so often? Or just mutate a little bit, get kicked out? But that was one of a favorite city, because it did feel...
It has a powerful, memorable core, essentially.
Especially when it has that division, right? Yeah, it has a division with the rest of, with the wasteland, which is like, the city ends here, and after this, there is nothing.
It's a strong boundary.
Yeah.
And it's easy to implement it, and even in open world settings, I mean, you can have very, very obvious boundaries. Even administrative ones, even a bloody sign will do. It's just like, this is the end of the city, here, look at it.
I mean, one thing that you've been doing quite a lot is, well, both writing and do you teach level design, or do you teach urban design at the moment?
Yes, I teach level design, but there tends to be a bit of city stuff.
Well, I would guess, like, out of you, there would have to be.
There would have to be. And yeah, it's sort of, it's unavoidable.
So what do you advise your students as entering to this? It's like, here's a couple of tips, just don't start doing this.
I mean, the first thing I tell them is like, please, whenever you do something, have a reason for doing it. It sounds obvious, that goes without saying, but it's not. Especially in younger kids, like in their early 20s or late 19-teens, whatever, it's those weird ages. They just, you know, don't realize.
It sounds cool, right? It's like, there is walkways everywhere with no handrails.
I think you're right. Like, instilling the question of why. So, like, questioning why we do these things. And, like, instilling that from such an early stage will benefit you so much as you grow as a level designer, because you won't stop doing it. You will just start doing it more with every level, every city, every game you build. You will just continually ask, why does this happen? And more importantly, why is this there? It can be as simple, why is that crate there? Does it serve a purpose?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's all about being honest with your level design. And I think generally games that keep their honesty level with their characters, story, levels, all of that, they're more believable. So if you create a city that it might look futuristic or whatever, but you create it in a way that there's something about it that, yeah, I can get behind that idea. I think that what makes it in the end a great city.
Being honest, I mean, this is indeed a pretty crucial remark. I think on some level it's always understood or felt, or people get it. People realize, even if they cannot quite express what it is that makes them like something, maybe because they like the proper trading, this is not their field, whatever, but they know that they like it and that it feels real and honest on a level, even if it's inexplicable.
And I think also we can separate level design of big towns and cities like that versus the environment design, where as a level designer, and you know, if you're going to create a city, you start blocking it out and you create the bigger space and see if that makes sense. Whereas I think environment design is about going to that specific room and thinking, okay, so what does that room have and why? Do you think there's distinction between that? Have you studied both sides of that?
I would say that there is a distinction, and I would say that there's a similarity. It's like saying urban planners and architects. It's like, I mean, first we get and we define spaces in broad strokes and, you know, do the heavy stuff, and then leave room for architects like to fill in. You know, like this is how a block is delineated, and this is how tall buildings can be, and this is how much space they can eat up, and this is what they'll be used for. And now you get in and do your thing. And I mean, when working in games, I can usually, you know, advise on the latter. I can talk about like aesthetics, and I can suggest things to the people who do them, but I cannot actually, you know, do much more besides, you know, a very, very rough mock-up or something like that. I mean, I don't do the artistic stuff at all.
One thing that I've seen a massive growth in, and I think I've sent you some of these things recently, is like, now that you've got access to OpenGIS, like the Google Maps was a kind of closed version, because that came from Keystone and other products that were very heavily commercial. And if people don't know what I'm talking about, Keystone was Google Earth, or was a company that did Google Earth before Google bought them and made it free. You know, you had to pay quite a lot of money. And then this OpenStreetMaps is a kind of version of Google Maps, but you can actually get access to the data and you can export it, and you get like a whole bunch of information. You can say whichever layers you want. And I know I'm getting a bit technical, but I have a point. I've been noticing a growth, or maybe it's my interest, I don't know, in tools like Houdini and Blender that are now tying into this, and then being able to get this real information and then do like, let's procedurally create a city by just saying like, okay, well, there's a river here, so therefore there'll be bridges every so often.
I know that it's being done on a project, actually. I mean, that they've combined OpenStreet data with Houdini and doing interesting things. Not so certain if it worked out as well as initially imagined.
I think there's a lot of random, and God hand needs to be a...
Yeah, it's. I think that we can take inspiration from real life configurations. I think that we can blatantly steal, you know, road plans and stuff and use them in certain cases. But it has to be done really carefully. I mean, it doesn't work out of the box, I would say.
Yeah, because copy-pasting a real-life city for the player mainly is boring because... It's not because it's the city we live in or whatever. It's just because it doesn't provide good gameplay or flow. It has no thought behind it. And there's a reason why in games we go from a snow area into a green plains area within like 20 seconds of like driving there. It's because it just makes the environment better. But and probably in real life, you wouldn't experience that. So copy-pasting a city from Google Earth, I would say, is probably not the greatest thing for level design.
I actually have a bugbear, which is exactly that. I've been playing Ghost Recon Breakpoint, and compared to the previous one set in Bolivia, my home country, this one does that, but there's like even like palm fronds, and suddenly goes from snow with, which you're going, I'm in a snowy jungle, how does that even work? And they go like, no, guys, keep it out, like, because, you know, in Bolivia it was like, oh, this is a snowy area, and it goes into this temperate area, this desert area, then in this more flora. But yes, I get your point. One game that I played, it's a small game called GTA 4 back in the time.
Oh, yeah, might have heard of it.
It's an indie thing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I was, you know, going to New York quite a lot, so I actually took my PlayStation 2, I think it was at the time, and actually took GTA 4 to show my friend, and I understood New York a lot better from just driving around in GTA 4. And to your point, Valentina, it was like the bits that weren't in the game were the boring bits. Not boring bits, because New York's interesting, but it was like, well, there's 5 or 10 blocks which are pretty much the same.
That's real life. Life is boring.
Yeah, you sort of distill what's right. True. Well, it's not. I wish. I'm jealous of people who are bored.
Yeah.
I just meant about, imagine creating a space where it's just urban little houses with fences, and that's your game. And if that was an open world shooting game with driving, I think I would get bored. If it was something about visiting your neighbors and like making cakes and giving it to them, that I'd be fine.
You know, it always has to do with the level of fidelity you choose. I mean, if you really want to do something which is, you know, a social thing, and I mean, I've worked recently on a game called Lake, and it's essentially about being, you know, a postman.
Mm-hmm.
And you just go around and deliver stuff, and you hear all those stories, and, you know, little arcs, and interesting people and less interesting people. So it's fine. It's like, this is the game. I mean, this is the flow and the sense and the feeling of the game. But exactly that, I mean, if you want to rush through and shoot at, you know, gangsters, whatever, you don't need that. You don't need to have, you know, like 50 buildings per building block. You can have 10, and they will be enough.
Even with GTA 5, sorry to bring in another GTA 1, I had a friend that worked on it, aside from our very own Valentina, and one of our conversations was, I really love the city, but the thing that really throws me is that some places you can go in and some places you can't.
Doesn't it make sense though?
Well, some places you can't, but some, you know, like some stores, and I was like, I want to break into somewhere and just like...
Thingmark means like some doors are not even interactable, you can't even go in, and then some are, so why can't you just enter all buildings, or what separates them exactly?
I understand the technical limitation, but it was like, now it makes me feel like it's one of these like Western cities that just has got like a front with a stick holding it up. Do you know what I mean? Like a facade.
There is a name for this type of city, and I think it's called Potemkin Village.
Right, that's right.
I think because they used to set up those facade fake villages with happy villagers for Catherine the Great to witness and be happy about the state of her empire.
Oh, really?
Something.
Yeah,
like
I think
that.
It's Potemkin Village. We'll have to.
I think.
Don't tweet us until.
It's not as if we have access to Google or anything, but
if we only had some kind of tool that we could just type into.
Yes, wouldn't be magical. Make it obvious to people that not everything is to be entered. I mean, obviously, right. if you look at a store, you want to enter it. Good, but if you look at a
private house,
you don't want to enter it. You've been trained not to. So I mean, if we make the places that are meant to be entered, like places like residents that are meant to be entered, then we've made them very obvious. I'm thinking like something very simple, like in LA Noir, you had like those different colored doorknobs.
Right.
Yeah, the golden ones, I think.
So, it's very simple. It's a stupid thing, but it sort of subtly and very quickly trained you to look for this. So everything else was, you know, lovely scenery, things to look at. Oh, look at Los Angeles during the 50s. But you instantly knew that a place of interest would have this, you know, yellow doorknob, this golden doorknob.
So. Something recent that I see in games that I really like is that all doors, they're realistic, so you don't know exactly whether you can get in or out, but they're all kind of interactable, so you go, you walk up to them, so the character will try to bump into it or open it, and it will be closed, and other ones, they will open, like, the character will open them, so all of them, if you have a realistic setting, can be, like, interacted with, but then you see whether you can enter it or not by what the character animation does at the time. I kind of like that. I know it's not very clear, but it's a bit more realistic rather than you just walking straight towards the door and nothing happening. It's just like, oh, keep playing the walking animation while you're walking at the door. It's like, no.
So one of the things that you should do in that design where you have like doors that you can open or you can't open it is that all idea of actually not say that you can't is but always be attracted to the ones that you can. But as you say, just make all the doors look the same. Otherwise, it's like a bit like Scooby-Doo.
I think when it comes like to that scenario of like in open world games with doors, I think like a while ago, I think even Rob put a tweet out about it. And it was like a joke saying, oh, we're having a meeting about the door system or whatever. And this was like Doors version 3. But in reality, you're going to go through about another several iterations of how the doors are going to function in your final game. But that's not just how they work. That's how they visually look. Then there's the choice of, do you now, when you're in a space, do I put a blocker in front of every one of those doors? So whether it's a bin, it's a barrier, it's a chain to make it believable, or do you do a render pass? So all the doors you can open look slightly different. Loads of games do this in loads of different ways. The barrier is usually the better one, but it has to be a very obvious like barrier to it as well. But that can be quite time consuming. If you have a massive city with lots of doors and you only want the player to go through maybe 25% of them. So the render pass thing is usually what gets done on bigger scale games.
And I understand that that's a technical limitation because, you know, there's only so many bits and bytes that we can actually play with in especially in open world games, right? No excuse, goddammit. I want my games to with fully realized interiors and everyone should have a life.
But I think that's kind of what I'd like to see from next gen, right? I don't really want better graphics or anything anymore. I want the computing power to go into more systems and AI.
Sometimes just trying to... I mean, I've looked at quite a lot of, for example, procedural systems for cities, and many of them are very impressive, but very few of them have the, you know, the proper logic at their core. They just start, you know, building things. They don't layer things. They don't try to you know, express history. The way Dwarf Fortress does its geology is brilliant. If you could do this for cities in a procedural generator, that would definitely come up with something way more interesting. But I mean, if we get to the point where we can at least generate very believable, I don't know, views, then that would have been a great step towards the right direction.
Konstantinos, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on.
Well, it has been a true pleasure for me too.
We didn't talk enough about poo, but oh. I think you'll have to have you back on the show and
for sewage system.
Do a special. Yeah.
Again, thank you very much. And if people wanted to follow you and find out more about game urbanism or how to become a game urbanist, where should they go?
Well, I could give out my address. They could
start following me. Send you actual letters.
So, yes. There's always Twitter. It's like at Gnomeslayer. And on Twitter, there's gamecities.com.
We'll put a link to the awesome book and the virtual cities.
Thank you.
And Wireframe Magazine, because they can catch you every 2 weeks.
Yes, and it's also available online too.
If you don't want actual things arriving in your house.
Yeah, it's nice to have it.
Yeah.
And it's nicely sized too.
And thank you, and till the next time.
Yeah.
Bye.
See you all, bye.
Bye. The Level Design Podcast has been a Command Studio production. Our editor is Matthew Lever, and this episode has been produced by Bridie Rose.